Struggling to keep track of your story and world? Archivos is for you. More intuitive than a wiki, more extensible than Scrivener, Archivos builds your story Bible into your personal, always-on tactical display. Graphical relationship charting, continuity tools, this thing has it all, with bonus options for fan engagement and real-time collaboration. I don't recommend tools I don't use, guys, and this one is good enough that even Open Source Me is using it for one of his projects instead of my trusty old wiki. Archivos. Story world management done right. www.archivos.digital. That's www.archivos.digital. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 785.
Today we hear from Kaylin, who asks...
I can't recall the episode you mentioned it. I have around 17 episodes stretched over the last few months or so still to listen to. But you stated that the fall of the Berlin Wall led directly to the current situation regarding global politics. Can you elaborate? What's the story there? Keep up the amazing work, and Kitty is my hero. Well, thank you.
Yeah, she's kind of cool. I like her. What can I say?
Curse you, Mr. Sawyer, for being perfect for her. Well, yeah. I'm weird, so him being perfect means he's pretty weird, so... Yeah.
Okay, so the story on how the fall of the Berlin Wall gave us today's world. I'm going to be cribbing a lot of this from the book The Accidental Superpower by Peter Zion, which I pimped a few days ago, mixing in with a lot of other sources that I've learned from over the years, and aiming it toward a non-wonky audience. So if you want more depth, check out the sources that I gave Vega 2 days ago. That'll let you get deep on this stuff pretty quickly. All right. So to understand the fall of the Berlin Wall and why it's important, you first have to understand World War II and what happened. In World War II, the imperial system that had ruled the world since 1500 came crashing down to zero. And... all of the navies in the world were completely destroyed, basically except ours, the Americans. By the way, those of you listening in other countries, I'm going to be narrating this as an American, so anytime I say ours, I mean the Americans. When the war was over, the Europeans expected the Americans to do what the Europeans would have done in their place, which is to... militarily occupy the country, turn them into colonies or tributary states of the main conquering nation, to gut their local industry, to transfer all the ownership of local industry to members of the conquering country, and basically to make them vassal states. The U.S. didn't do that for two reasons. First, its imperial adventures in the late 19th and early 20th century had not gone all that well. There wasn't anything the Americans needed from the wider world to make the trouble of building an empire worth it, and that meant that imperial ambitions in America have always been a bit dubious in terms of justifiability, because imperialism has native bad PR in America, i.e., Americans don't like empires. So anytime we act like one, we have to make up a story so that we don't feel like we're being the bad guys. I mean, there's a reason that the bad guys in Star Wars are the Empire, because Americans don't like empires, on principle. So that was one reason. Another reason we didn't do it that way was that we had a bigger problem. There were two major powers to survive World War II. There was us, and there was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was the most powerful land-based empire the world had seen since Rome. They were not to be screwed with. They were very, very terrifying, and they had an endless well of population that they had no problem drafting and throwing en masse at any invading army or any country they wished to conquer, and taking an endless list of casualties, because they didn't care about their people. They saw them as a resource for conquering territory. And the Russians have this problem where they're not secure as a country if they don't control Eastern Europe, because Moscow and St. Petersburg, or at the time it was Moscow and Leningrad, sit on the edge of the Northern European Plain, which is basically the Eastern and Northern European marching grounds. Anyone with an army and a little bit of ambition eventually marches across the plain to try to conquer it, because it's where all the good farmland is. And the edge of that is Moscow and St. Petersburg, which have ports. And you'd be an idiot not to conquer those if you're going to the trouble of conquering the plain, as well as the fact that it's the only nearby staging ground for a counteroffensive. So Napoleon and Hitler and several other German princes and occasionally warlords from elsewhere have marched across that plain over and over and over for centuries and centuries, and the Russians have stopped them because as long as they can slow them down enough till winter hits, you can't supply an army over the Northern European plain because there aren't enough rivers running through it to get good supply lines. So all of that is the background. The Russians had an existential interest in conquering Eastern Europe, and then they had an ambition, a stated ambition, to conquer the rest of the world and bring it under communism. It was baked into the philosophy since at least Lenin and Trotsky, and I would have to go back and check because it's been a couple of decades since I read Das Kapital and the Manifesto, but I think it was baked into the philosophy since Marx. So they were an empire with global ambitions, and they were intent on crushing Europe under the boot heel. And that creates a problem for America. America has this amazingly secure physical geography. We've got oceans on two sides. It's very hard to move an army across an ocean, but it's really easy to move trade. So we're naturally amenable to trading with anyone that we need to, and can easily defend our east and west borders. And then to the north, we're buffered by forests and mountains and one wide plain. So it's very hard for the Canadians to invade us. The only place where we're weak for them to invade us, they invaded us in 1812, burned down the capital. We figured out how to prevent that. They haven't been back since. But America and Canada were blood enemies until basically the First World War because of that reason. And of course, from the south, you've got Mexico, and we fought the Mexicans for 100-some-odd years to make sure that we got the whole swath of North America going east to west, because that made the country completely physically securable. You can't really move armies across the Chihuahua Desert. So America is almost invasion-proof, and America has all its waterways running through all its arable and industrial lands, so it's very, very self-sufficient when you pair all of those lands and all of those waterways with its abundance of natural resources like oil and granite and steel and copper and everything. America can basically be an island nation to itself whenever it wants to. Unless there is one scenario in which America could fall to invasion. And that is if a single power controls both Berlin and Moscow. If one power controls the Northern European plain, the seaports from Hamburg to Sevastopol, the vast natural resources of the Russian interior, and North Sea access that the Russians have during the summer, if one power were to control all of that, that power would have the resources, the manpower, the engineering genius, the organizational genius, the logistical genius, the seaports, and the resources and the wealth to invade and conquer North America. Therefore, since the late 19th century, it has been American policy to prevent that from ever happening. That's one of the reasons that Berlin was split during the Treaty of Munich. It was part of holding that line. So the Americans are faced with what was, to us, the only potential existential danger on the planet. And we'd just fought a major war in which basically the rest of the planet had been wiped out, militarily speaking. So we got all of our allies together at the Mount Washington Resort in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And over the course of, I think it was a week or a week and a half, the Americans basically said to everybody, okay, here's how it's going to be. We're not going to militarily occupy you. We're not going to turn you into vassal states. We're going to do something different. This whole World War business, this four European wars every century thing, you got to cut that shit out. It's useless. We don't like it. It's annoying. We keep having to bail your asses out because we can't let the Germans conquer Russia or the Russians conquer the Germans. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to rebuild you. We're going to make the American Navy the policeman of the world so that you won't have to worry about pirates or interdiction or anything as long as you guys don't fight each other. That's illegal now. No more fighting amongst yourselves. And in exchange, we will police the sea lanes. You'll be able to ship anything, anywhere, anytime. And you can all export anything you can produce to the American market, and we will absorb it. The American market was huge. There was lots of consumer demand, more consumer demand than the American industrial plant of the time could ever, ever fill up. And so it wasn't a big deal for us. But in this way, we got everybody on side, and we said the condition is that you have to fight the Cold War our way. We say jump, you say how high, you bring your military units in wherever we say, and we will protect you from the Soviets, and you will help us do it, because there's not enough of us to do the job alone. This worked pretty well. This worked terrifyingly well. It worked so well that over the course of the 80 years since, the global population tripled. We've got the lowest proportion of global population ever in poverty. Places that could never have hoped to develop based on their local resource situation alone, like Brazil, have become these major hubs of economic activity. Or places like China. China has been united for 300 of its 3,000-year history, and 80 of those years have been under the world order that we established at Bretton Woods, and most of the rest of it was under the Mongolians. China's a very hard place to unite. And even the Russians did pretty well out of this once the Soviet Union fell. But what happened is it wasn't a static alliance. Every time a new power came on side, like China, we folded them into the system. This gave us the 30 glorious years after World War II, where standards of living were rising all over the world. Growth was immeasurable. The baby boom happened. There was lots and lots of new market demand everywhere. And the countries that had been destroyed because of World War II got rebuilt to the point where the American market could no longer absorb their output, which happened in the 80s, coming on the heels of the baby boom generation being so numerous that there weren't enough jobs to go around, so the price of labor in America crashed. That's what broke the union movement, and there were basically, because of women's lib, which was a secondary consequence of the low labor rates, there were four times more new workers coming into the market in the 70s than there had been in the late 50s. So there was a major, major labor crash. Another one of the consequences is that the Americans could never decline a war. If it involved anything to do with the Soviets, we had to be there. Or we would lose credibility and the alliance might break. And up until the late 70s, we had to have the alliance in order to be secure because we could not fight the Soviets on our own. That got us into places like Korea and Vietnam because there was no choice geopolitically, even though those wars were stupid by themselves and unjustifiable by any theory of just war ever proposed in the history of Western civilization. This brings us up to the 1980s. America did not expect to win. Because of our insularity, because we are so far away from everything else, because we have no real experience with the kinds of hardships that are normal in the rest of the world, we freak out anytime something little happens. Sputnik. It fell out of the sky shortly before we launched Vanguard 1, which was a communication satellite, not just a beacon, and it's still up there doing its job. But because the Soviets beat us, we were convinced we'd lost the Cold War, and we retooled everything about our economy in order to catch up. Americans do this. We're crazy. And we're crazy because we're insulated. But one of the things about being crazy is that we are always convinced that we're looking at the decline of America. despite the fact that for 150 years we've exited every decade in a better strategic and economic position than we've entered it, which is a record that no country in history, including the Roman Empire, has. So, Americans are crazy, and part of that crazy is we never even considered that we would win. We expected that the only way the Cold War would end was with a nuclear war. So we didn't make any plans on what would happen the next day. A forward-thinking people would have had plans in place to bring the Soviets into the alliance network, to make it a permanent thing, to rebalance it so that it could serve American economic needs so Americans wouldn't lose interest, and everybody's security needs, and we could continue the global uplift that had been a byproduct, that had been the bribe that brought everyone on side in the first place. But we didn't do that. Instead, we voted the most foreign policy-centric president we've ever had out of office because he dared to say that we needed to, and words like New World Order scared us. Because we're Americans. We don't like foreign policy. Foreigners are people over on the other side of the world who need to mind their own business. So because we didn't have that conversation then, and in every single presidential contest since, we elected the domestic policy candidate, the candidate that ran touting their lack of foreign policy experience and expertise as a virtue, and in the last contest with Trump and Clinton, even though Clinton won the popular vote, if she had won, this would still be true because she was on the campaign trail talking about getting out of every trade relationship that we'd ever been in, including the treaties that she'd personally helped negotiate. Because in the fall of the Berlin Wall, the world order had served its purpose. Its purpose was to keep us safe. It had no other purpose. Everything else was this beautiful byproduct. And once it wasn't keeping us safe, it was a net cost to us. We're on the wrong side of all the import trade equations. It costs a lot of money to float the American Navy, which outguns the rest of the world combined 20-1. And Americans aren't that interested in the rest of the world. This has got good and bad points if you're an American, and it's got only bad points if you're not an American. Once the Cold War was over, as a culture, right, left, and center, we had no reason to stick around, except by that time we'd become a little dependent on Middle Eastern oil. Now, under the order, that wasn't a problem because we had to keep the Middle East open to supply Europe and the Far East anyway, but it's not a coincidence that we started hardcore research into hydraulic fracturing or fracking of oil from shale rocks the moment that Middle Eastern oil dependency became a danger to us again during the early parts of the Iraq War. Starting in 2007, oil shale became commercially viable, and those $100 a barrel prices we were seeing in the early 2000s fell. And they fell permanently because oil shale in the U.S. is now got a break-even price of about $40 a barrel, and it's got a production level just shy of Saudi Arabia's oil fields. So price just above and a production level just shy. North America as a unit has been energy independent for 3 years. The United States itself has been a net energy exporter for about a year and a half now. That means that every piece of the chain that links America to the global system is broken. We don't use the trade. We never have. At our peak, only 8% of our GDP was involved with trade, and half of that was within NAFTA. So we could get rid of all the trade outside of North America at our peak and only suffer a recession as bad as 1992's. We don't need the oil anymore. And we don't need the security that the alliance provides, and so we're going home. We haven't had a carrier battle group on patrol in the Persian Gulf since 2014. We've occasionally had one happen by, but we haven't had regular patrols. And the Straits of Hormuz are very easy to close. They're very small. Iran can close them by throwing missiles from their shoreline, hit anything that goes through the straits, or a single destroyer can close the whole straits. It takes a U.S. carrier battle group to keep the straits open. Iran and Saudi Arabia are now at open war. Iran is blowing up Saudi oil fields and processing facilities, and the Sauds are returning the favor. And that means that the rest of the world's energy supply is in bad shape. It's in very dangerous shape, especially with the Russians getting all stroppy, because their demographic cliff means that they have to secure their old borders in Eastern Europe, or they will never again be able to defend Moscow from invasion. Which is why they took the Ukraine, which is why they've bought off Belarus, which is why they reconquered Georgia, and which is why Putin is doing this amazing military build-out, because their demographic situation is worse than China's. That was a result of the fall of the Berlin Wall, too. The lack of state coercion meant there was a big baby bust because suddenly birth control was very readily accessible and the state didn't have a say in your sex life. At the same time they got hit with the influx of Westerners, they got hit with the AIDS epidemic and with a big tuberculosis epidemic at the same time. So they have no Xers and no millennials. And unfortunately, neither does everywhere else. The Chinese and the Russians are the worst, but everywhere else looks almost as bad. Germany's almost as bad. Well, France and New Zealand are in good shape, and the U.S. is in good shape of the developed world, and Mexico is in the best shape in the developing world, but even it's starting to turn now. Brazil, Australia, Britain, everywhere. In some of these countries, like Greece and Italy, the demographics are terminal. They're basically over as countries when the current generation retires. And that's a result of so much prosperity, so fast, giving birth to environmental concerns about overpopulation, and more proximately, making birth control not just available, but necessary, because when you urbanize, children are a liability instead of an asset. If you're in a rural area, children are an asset. They can do chores, they can help build the family business, they can work in the family store, they can help run the farm. In an urban environment, children are only an economic drain, so you can only have them if you've got enough money to have them as a luxury good. You can only have enough money to have them as a luxury good if your whole society has an ever-increasing standard of living. And that hasn't been reliably true since the boomers entered the workforce en masse and depressed all the wages. So the boomers delayed their childbearing, which is why there's no Generation X anywhere. Then they had kids late in life, largely speaking, and those are the millennials. And America, France, and New Zealand are the only countries that have them. Everywhere else they didn't. However, every governmental system in the world since 1500 has been predicated upon something that the economist Eric Weinstein calls embedded growth obligations. The pension schemes, the socialized medicine, the insurance industry, the economic and military strategies of nation states, everything is based on the notion that tomorrow tax revenues, economic growth, etc. will be higher than it was yesterday. And with the exception of when things got knocked out by a war, that was always true because since 1500, there have been trading ports to discover. There's been technological revolution after technological revolution, one after the other. And since World War II, there's been rapid base effect growth as 60% of the world industrialized from agrarian under the nuclear umbrella that the Americans provided. So there's been massive, massive growth, endless good times that would never end, and so nobody had kids, and so now they're ending. The boomers move into mass retirement in 2022, worldwide. That means that they're going to be pulling their retirement savings out of the stock market and the bond market, which is where all of the credit comes from that makes home mortgage rates 0 to 4%, that makes credit card rates 8 to 12%. When that capital all goes away, credit's going to dry up. In this order, it's going to dry up for foreign markets first, except for capital flight out of China and Europe because of collapse in those two places. So that will soften the blow in other places because people who can get their money out will be trying to get their money out ahead of the wars. So that'll soften the blow elsewhere. But generally speaking, capital markets will go back to historic norms. First, in terms of foreign investment, then in terms of consumer credit, then in terms of mortgages, And that means that interest rates over the next 5 to 6 years are going to do something between doubling and quintupling. So if you have an adjustable rate loan of any kind, the time to refinance it is now, because it will not ever be cheaper. And if it adjusts up 5 times what it is now, you won't be able to afford it. This means housing prices are going to crash domestically and internationally, because the credit available to borrow for houses is going to get so much more expensive, no one will be able to afford it. And the demand for housing is going to go down because there aren't enough people to replace the generation that's retiring and dying off anywhere except the U.S. But there we still have the credit problem. So this is a long way of answering your question. The failure to have a realistic conversation about geography, population, and world intergovernmental coordination on economic matters, all of which are a direct result of the memories of World War II, where the Nazis employed the state-of-the-art knowledge at the time of population control and economics and geopolitics, put all of those to very, very destructive, nefarious use, and turned them all ideological. It made the kinds of conversations that we would have had to have in the 90s difficult. And the American lack of interest in having any conversation about any of these things, because this all happens to people on the other side of the world and doesn't affect us much, thank God now that the Soviets are dead, that made it not just difficult to have that conversation, it made it impossible. So as a result, the Bretton Woods World Order has been running on fumes for 30 years, and it is now overdetermined that it's going to go away. The U.S. now has fewer internationally deployed forces than at any time since 1920. It is rapidly on course to bring back everybody, so it will have the smallest international footprint that it's had since before the Spanish-American War. Without the U.S. patrolling the seas, piracy comes back. International competition for shipping lanes comes back. Colonialism comes back, because the European powers will have no choice but to go and reinterface with their former colonies to secure energy and raw materials supplies. The success of the Bretton Woods Order, combined with the tragic failure of the Americans to dream up what comes next, and then their refusal to have a conversation about it, as well as the refusal of anyone else in the world to have a conversation, because most leaders in Europe especially were really glad just to be out from under all the stress of imminent destruction every day. And China didn't want to have a conversation about it because they wanted to sneak up and overtake the U.S. before they had to rely on the U.S. for any of its security guarantees. That's not going to happen now. All of those things together form this tragic package that mean that the greatest period of peace and prosperity in human history is creating all the conditions it takes to bring us back to a world that functions militarily like the Imperial Age, and that functions economically like the Feudal Age, because we don't have any political philosophies that aren't predicated on embedded growth obligations, and we haven't since 1500. So we've got to dream it all up again, and it's going to be interesting to see who can do the dreaming, and how fast, and what it'll take to motivate people to dream together again. So that's the whole story. And by the way, if you're a millennial, don't get too comfortable, because once war breaks out in Europe, you're going to be facing job competition from high-skilled European immigrants fleeing the war zones. And that's going to do to your wages right as you're starting to get bargaining power for the first time in the labor markets in 40 years. That's going to do to your wages what having so many people in their generation did to the boomers' wages, and then kept suppressing the Xers' wages by extension. On the other hand, books are good, cheap entertainment, and high-budget entertainment is going to become more difficult to produce because credit's going to be thinner, so we could be facing a bull market in books. Anyway, I could probably go on about the different implications of this for a couple of hours, but I've been recording for 40 minutes here, so it's probably time to wrap it up. I hope you guys have enjoyed this, and again, check the links in the show notes for today and for the last 2 days for further reading, and good luck. I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty McKeon and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.